animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animal. Talking animal. Talking animal. Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before we go any further, I want to thank Bev Capshaw for sitting in for me last Wednesday, delivering a stellar edition of the show. On today's show, my guest is Ellen Quinlan, Executive Director of the Darbster Foundation, an organization whose chief mission involves plucking cats and dogs from crowded South Florida shelters and finding homes and transportation for them in the adoption-friendly, by comparison at least, New England area. The Darbster Foundation has an unusual origin story, springing from Quinlan and her husband opening in a vegan restaurant despite having zero experience in the restaurant business. We'll hear about the reason for launching that restaurant, how it's going now, having traveled that learning curve, how things evolved into an interstate rescue and adoption operation, and more when I speak with Ellen Quinlan in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in today's program, I'll speak briefly with H.H. German, the writer-creator of Calico, what may be the first comic book hero dedicated to fighting animal abuse. I spoke with German not quite a year ago when he was launching this 8-issue series, and now that he's about to publish issue number 4, the halfway mark of the series, I thought we'd check in with him for an update, see how Calico has been received, and so on. That conversation will happen later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss all things Darbster, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Ellen Quinlan on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So in a moment or two, we'll sort out the Darbster nomenclature, which I suspect I already screwed up because it's hard to track all the Darbsters and which goes where and what does what. So it's, you know, a little hard to tell them without a program, but we will come back to that in a sec. First, let's address a bit of your history in the pre-Darbster area. Let's start, not surprisingly, with animals. I'm guessing animals have long been important to you. What do they mean to you when you were a kid, for example?
Oh, when I was a kid, I was one of those quiet kids who was more comfortable with animals than people, and had a lot of pets, and then stopped eating meat at about the age of 12. Much to my parents' dismay, I survived on a lot of cereal for a number of years.
Wow.
So they've always been a big part of my life.
Yeah, and I take it animals were probably important to the family as well, even if they didn't feel as strongly on some parts of it as you did.
Yeah, we always grew up with cats and dogs and, you know, went out to guinea pigs and rabbits occasionally, but we were kind of just your typical American family like that.
Now, were there other people in your family that also stopped eating meat, especially as young as you did at age 12?
Just my little sister. She kind of followed along, and to this day, she's still a vegetarian, vegan convert.
Wow. Okay, cool. She was influenced by you, I guess. When you did it, she said, well, my big sister's doing it, I'm doing it as well.
Yeah, probably that. And my mom was never a very good cook anyway, so it wasn't too much of a sacrifice.
Okay, so it was partly a commentary on the cooking, I guess, as well as any philosophical element. Yeah. And so you stopped eating meat then. Now, where, relative to being 12, and your sister duplicating kind of your move there, when did it go from stop eating meat and presumably vegetarian for a certain period of time to shifting into vegan?
I was probably vegetarian till probably mid to late 30s. And then I ended up going to a weekend that I think PETA or one of those big organizations had sponsored. And I was with my then future husband, who was not a vegetarian at all, and we came away from that, and he said to me, he goes, oh, well, we should just be vegan if we're going to be vegetarian. So I really didn't have a leg to stand on at that point. So we both went from, well, I went from vegetarian to vegan at that point, and he went from carnivore to vegan at that point.
Wow.
And that was probably back in 1999, 2000, somewhere around there.
I have to say, I'm curious what sort of conference or what sort of talk this was, because it's one thing to go shift a little bit from vegetarian to vegan, but for your then future husband to make that gigantic leap, there must have been some pretty persuasive information or talks being given.
I don't think he had any idea of factory farming in the United States at that point.
Okay.
So I think, you know, learning about that, and, you know, seeing what really happens. And it wasn't just this. He used to listen to Don Imus. I don't know if you remember him.
Sure.
DJ. And he was a big opponent of the CAFO farms and the factory farming. So I think, you know, just opening his ears to learn about it made a huge difference, his ears and eyes.
Yeah, and it sounds like because of IMS and maybe other things, he was particularly open and maybe ready based on what you guys heard at that conference.
Yeah, I think anybody who, you know, I think most people that if they really understand what goes into it, you know, they'll at least think about moving more towards a non-meat diet.
For sure. Well, that's why I think some of these films, especially some that maybe are a little bit less shrill or graphic, which I think can cut both ways sometimes. But I think the other ones that are a little more textured in that way really have a big impact, because I think people are startled, alarmed at what they're learning and seeing, but they're not so put off that it almost has a counterproductive sort of element to it. So.
Yeah, I would agree.
So when did you start then spending time in South Florida? Put me on the timeline that we've discussed.
We both have businesses, and my business was pension administration, just setting up 401ks and corporate pension plans and doing the accounting and legal work on them.
Mm-hmm.
And he did software, or does software still to this day. So we could kind of live anywhere we wanted to live. So we ended up migrating down here to West Palm Beach because I didn't really like the cold. He came from California, and I didn't really want to move to California.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up coming down here, and we were both just, you know, working our individual businesses in West Palm Beach.
I see.
That's how we ended up down here.
Right, because the businesses sound like could really operate or be based pretty much anywhere, so you just figured, let's go where it's more comfortable. I'm not going all the way to California, but I want to get out of the cold.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Cool. So I think we're probably starting to brush up against where the Darbshire origin story may be starting. Because tell me how that did begin, because I guess having made that shift that we've already talked about, you guys were probably always on the lookout for good vegan food. And so sort of tell me, kind of pick up that narrative from there, if you would.
Yeah, so we moved down to Florida full-time back in 2003, and there really were not a lot of great places to eat, especially when you went from vegetarian to vegan.
Yeah.
So we're in West Palm, so we always found ourselves driving 40 minutes south of here to go to a nice restaurant named Sublime that was owned by a lady named Nancy Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know who she is.
Yeah.
But so we were driving down there once a week or so, and you know, it's kind of getting to be a hassle.
Sure.
So a little kind of hole-in-the-wall place about 2 miles from our house went up for sale. And we both liked real estate. We dabbled in, you know, investing in multifamilies and things like that, you know, little commercial properties. So it wasn't very expensive because it was 2009 and we were going into that real estate debacle that happened back then. And the property also had a billboard on it, which generated some income.
Oh.
So we ended up buying the place for, I think it was like $290,000. And it was in a bit of disarray, but it was right on a canal. So it had a little bit of waterfront seating. And it had been kind of a Mexican place. And the gentleman that had owned it actually died in a motorcycle crash on 95.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah. So we ended up buying it, figuring, you know, hey, let's try to open a vegan restaurant. Nice place for us to eat. There's got to be other people like us around here. And no, if it fails, it fails. We'll just keep the property and rent it to somebody else. So we started that endeavor back in February of 2009, and it took us till November of 2009 to actually get the place open. And that's kind of where it started. Back in 2009.
Tell me a little bit more about what that was like, because it sounds like you guys were both, you know, successful in the business. In the businesses that you had, the respective businesses that you had. But right. I'm wondering what the conversations were like, because it sounds like, at least in part, it's like, okay, I'm sick of driving 40 minutes to go have the kind of food that we really most enjoy having, so we should have our own restaurant. But was it kind of like, hey, we can do this, we're successful in other fields, how hard can it be to open a restaurant? Or tell me like some of the discussions and sort of the rationale for saying, hey, here's a thing that's for sale, it's waterfront, it seems cool, let's buy this and go for it.
Well, I think we both figured if we could run our other businesses naively, how difficult could it be to run a business, run a restaurant? Because if the income sheet's black, you're doing okay. If it's red, you're not doing so well.
So it's really the nuts and bolts is the way you guys were looking at it then, it sounds like.
Yeah, and we both had employees, so we kind of were used to dealing with employees. This place wasn't going to be very big. It seats about 60 people, 30, 35 inside, 30, 35 outside. So it was, to us, it was manageable.
Mm-hmm.
And then my husband's also a very good cook. So he could take typical meat dishes and pretty easily make them vegan.
Yeah.
They would taste good. But he never had any big restaurant experience.
Yeah.
We were lucky that a lady that we knew in our neighborhood had kind of been looking for something to do. Her name was Kathy. And her previous experience was she had run a Dallas restaurant that was Italian. And it sat about, I don't know, I want to say 200, 250 people.
Wow.
So she knew how to take recipes and make them viable for a restaurant environment.
Yeah.
So between February and the time we opened in November, we worked with her and her partner a lot over that summer, probably having dinners once a week, tweaking what we saw was going to be the menu.
Mm-hmm. What was that like? What were some memorable kind of early challenges, even as you guys were seeking the help of someone who had serious and larger scale restaurant experience? I mean, I can only imagine early on, because you mentioned the naively, which I thought was pivotal, that it must have been kind of way more tricky and involved than maybe you guys had first imagined when you bought the property.
It was just, the landfalls or the pitfalls were just, it almost seemed like one thing after another.
Mm-hmm.
Staffing to this day continues to be a challenge. It's just the job market, and it's the environment of working in a restaurant. It's not the easiest place to work.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, you know, that was a challenge to get a good team together in the front of the house and the back of the house that could really make things work smoothly. And then we had little challenges. I mean, we had to get our liquor license. That's always a fiasco.
Sure.
And then within a month of opening, the city decided that it was time to dig up the street we were on and replace all the water pipes.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So it was just, it was kind of one thing after another. But, you know, we kind of just started out slow. I mean, I remember when we started, we were happy if we did $700 or $800 in a night. So we had little goals. We kept it going.
Yeah.
And, you know, we went through a few iterations of, you know, our kitchen, our lead in the kitchen. And right now we've been very fortunate. We've had the same people running the kitchen for about 8 or 9 years at this point.
Oh, that's great.
Wow.
Yeah. Because really, we're talking about a whole span of about 12 years from when you opened to just a little past that mark now. So
right.
So that's great that once kind of there was some learning curve travel and some trying different folks out, whatever, that's great that it's been so stable since.
Yeah, it's been pretty stable. But we had to learn the whole business. I mean, the restaurant business is a business of nickels and dimes.
Yeah.
Whereas where we lived before was you'd walk into a company and say the cost to set up a pension plan is going to be $2,000, and they would say, okay. And, you know, the restaurant business, if we're doing $2,000 in a night, it's a heck of a lot more work to get that $2,000.
For sure, yeah.
So you got to look at the price of everything. And we learned all about keeping food costs and labor costs within certain percentages of the overall revenue. And once we got a formula as to where we knew we should be,
mm-hmm.
We started to turn that corner and and become profitable probably about two and a half years in.
Oh, that's great. That's also fairly fast by a lot of timetables of new restaurants and stuff. So let me ask you this, Ellen. So, and this maybe is partly answered by those folks that have been there for 8-9 years. But do you now, like, love owning and running a restaurant? I mean, is it just like, okay, well, this is kind of what we had imagined when we first saw that building over there and said, okay, we could do this and that'll cut down on our drives to get the kind of food we most enjoy. I mean, is it now like really pleasurable, or is there still like some ups and downs that you just are just the nature of running a restaurant?
I think 85 to 90% of the time we really enjoy it. We enjoy going in there. We enjoy the people that work there. You know, 10% of the time, you know, you still got your issues.
But sure.
They're very, very minor in comparison to the good times.
And how often do you eat at Darbshire?
We're open 5 nights a week. I would say we're there 4.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Okay. So really, I mean, all these years later, it still has really paid off versus like the, making that drive, that 40-minute drive.
Oh.
Yeah. So you're really... In some ways, it really, despite some of the struggles and whatever, really did solve that problem. It sounds like three, four nights a week. That's great.
And we've met some great people there. So it's been fun. We kind of refer to it as our clubhouse sometimes.
Nice. Well, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Ellen Quinlan, Executive Director of the Darbshire Foundation, whose chief mission involves plucking cats and dogs from crammed shelters and finding homes and transportation accordingly for them in the adoption-friendly New England area. The Darbshire Juggernaut, as we're just hearing now, includes a vegan restaurant that had its own kind of unusual origin or story. If you'd like to ask Ellen a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org. Or text 813-433-0885. So somewhere along the line, if I'm not mistaken, you started to become more and more aware of the tricky and tough shelter situation in South Florida, with shelters pretty well crammed with cats and dogs, and many sadly don't make it out.
Yeah. So we opened the restaurant in 2009. And during this whole time, I was still, you know, volunteering at the local community shelters. You know, fostering kittens or, you know, minor things like that. So in 2012, when the restaurant started turning a profit, we figured, you know, what are we going to do with the money? Because we had our other jobs. So we formed the foundation. And 50 cents of every item that we sell goes into the foundation. So it's not really based on profitability. It's based on number of items we sell, because we didn't want it to be dependent on the restaurant having to do well. So we started to take that money and fund a lot of spay-neuter programs in our community in Palm Beach County, because there continues to be a lot of stray cats and kittens running around here. And then we expanded a little bit more, and we went into heartworm positive dogs at the local county shelter. So we opened that program up. And then at the same time, I kind of started doing more with the dogs at Palm Beach Animal Control. And you started to learn what the live release rates were. And they were pretty dismal back then. The live release rates for cats was about 29%. In dogs, especially squarehead or bully breed dogs, the live release rate was probably around 50%.
And for sorry, Ellen, to interrupt, but just for folks listening who may not be as familiar with that term, can you explain a little bit more about what the live release rate really means?
Yeah, it's very simple. If 10 cats go into the shelter and your live release rate is 29%, 3 of those cats are going to make it out alive. The other 7 are going to be euthanized.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, and Florida's still in the top 4 worst states in the country for euthanasia. So unfortunately, certain communities have done really well, but we're still not doing, you know, super well as a whole.
Yeah, collectively as a state, it's tough for sure.
Yeah. You get away from the coast and it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
So this was going on, and I still had the pension company, and a lot of my employees actually for the pension company were based up in New England. There was a good concentration of them in New Hampshire and some in Massachusetts. So they would come down here to visit with clients, and inevitably they would say to me, oh, do you have any kittens? And I'd be like, well, why do you want a kitten? Oh, my neighbor wants a kitten. We want a kitten. And I'm like, well, just can't you go to the shelter up there and get a kitten? And they were like, well, no, they don't have any kittens up there, and they really don't have any cats. Any cats that they have are either old or feral. So I was kind of like, well, this can't be right.
Yeah. I was just thinking after what you just said and explained about the live return rate, I mean, were you just incredulous upon first hearing this, or?
Yeah, and considering I came from that area, I didn't get it. So I still go up to that area because I have family up there. So I went up there, and I went around to all the shelters in New Hampshire. There were probably 12 or 14 of them. And the people were right. There were no kittens in these shelters. And a lot of them would have 5 or 6 adult cats. And a lot of the cats that they had probably were not cats you'd want to adopt out to a family with kids because they had, you know, behavior problems. They're not bad cats, but, you know, you may not want to hang out with a 2-year-old. Yeah. So we figured, okay, well, both supply and demand, we can move the cats from Florida to New Hampshire and get them adopted. So we started that back in 2004, I think it was, end of 2004. And I was, again, naive, didn't realize that there were all these laws having to do with, you know, the import and export of animals.
Oh, across state lines, you mean? Or
Yeah. You can bring anything into Florida.
Yeah.
But when you try to But when you try to bring it into a state like New Hampshire or Massachusetts, the borders are closing. So anyways, we got licensed with the DOA, the Department of Agriculture up there. And we ended up buying a small building in Manchester, New Hampshire, about 2,500 square feet. And we built it out basically as a cat shelter. And that was opened in 2015, in the summer of 15. As time went on, other shelters up there, which were resistant initially to taking cats from out of state, kind of started to get on board. So we started to transport not only to our shelter, but to other shelters in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And that's kind of how that Darbster Kitty got rolling.
Yeah, and I promised we'd try to cover this earlier. So we've covered Darbster, the restaurant, or Darbster Bistro, and we've touched, obviously, on Darbster Foundation. But then there's also Darbster for each of the two animals that you have kind of set up facilities in New England, right? There's Darbster Doggy and Darbster Kitty.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And then the overall thing, if I, please correct me because this is starting to feel like I need a schematic here. the overall effort that governs that is Darbster Rescue.
Yeah, Darbster Rescue and Darbster Foundation are basically one and the same.
Okay,
When we set up, we were more of a foundation because we were just providing funds for people to do things with.
Okay.
But then once we actually just, you know, started rescuing the animals, we did a, you know, doing business as Darbster Rescue as well. It's all one 501(c)(3).
Yeah.
And it's just one 501(c)(3). It's just the little components that are under it.
I see. And we've kind of talked about this over the years in different parts of the country, but when you saw and verified what you first probably seemed kind of, hard to accept, that when people are in South Florida, they're saying, hey, we're from New Hampshire or wherever, and we're having trouble adopting an animal, there just aren't enough animals. Is it beyond just the geography? What else accounts for such striking differences in terms of the shelters, South Florida, and really, as we've talked about, other parts of Florida, compared to ones in and around New England where you have your facilities, but elsewhere? Because it just seems like it's more broad there. But what does account for that?
Well, it's broad in the fact it's somewhat of a north-south thing. I mean, your four worst states in the country right now are Texas, I think South Carolina, Florida, and Southern California.
Mm.
So I think some of it, very little probably, maybe 20% of it, has to do with climate, especially as it pertains to cats and kittens.
Okay.
Because they, you know, can just breed and breed, and the weather's never going to impact it most of the time. I think education maybe has something to do with it. Just the idea that you should spay and neuter your animals because they will you know, keep populating.
Yeah.
And then some of the states up north, New Hampshire was one, for instance, they were very strict on people registering their animals and making sure that the animals were fixed when they were being registered.
Hmm.
So some of the northern states have also done programs like that, which has helped to significantly reduce the number of unwanted pets in those areas.